Brian Kiley.
I'm Jude Sanders.
And I'm Josh Ute.
And this is Engaging Culture, a podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. On this episode, we're going to look at the promise and limitations of Ozempic and drugs of the like. We're going to try to separate fact from fiction when it comes to DEI, what it actually is, and some principles we can use to think about it. And we're going to talk about what bad behavior on airplanes has to teach us about entitlement and how we can live less entitled lives. We'll have some fun along the way, of course. All of that and more on this episode of Engaging Culture. Well, hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. To start out today, I just want to point out, Josh, you came and joined us as a co-host for two episodes and then left.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming back. I just, you know, really stepping into that host spot. Your reliability is inspiring.
We appreciate you.
Yeah, you know, two out of three Hall of Fame numbers.
You're doing great
in your probation period.
Thank you.
Yes, you are. All right. Given my disdain for pre-podcast banter, we're going to jump right into it. Judah, what is the best thing you saw this week?
So the best thing I saw this week, I stumbled on this article from Good News Network that just like talks about positive things that have happened in the world. Because, you know, the news is stressful.
What?
Yeah, imagine. And so this was personal for me because I went to, a few years ago, I went to Brazil. And while I was in Brazil, I saw like a lot of really hard poverty. I remember we were walking through a favela, which is a poor neighborhood with people of color. And the woman who was leading us said, we can't go down this street because there might be bodies in the street.
Yikes.
So while I was there, one of the positive things that I saw or I learned about was that they have this reading literacy kind of recidivism program where basically inmates get time off for every book that they read.
Wow.
And it's been fairly effective in Brazil. And then Italy started doing it too. And the U.S. now is looking and exploring what that could look like here.
So time off your sentence for reading.
For reading.
Particular books.
I don't remember. I don't think
Captain Underpants is getting you a year off.
Listen,
your
don't be disrespectful, but... first of all. Great, the great it almost made the final cut. It's in the Apocrypha, but yeah, it almost the final cut.
Okay.
But it's just cool that we are in a position. I know not everybody might think that this is a good idea, but like, you know, kind of at the end of the day, jail, prison, all of that is supposed to be about rehabilitation.
Yes.
Right. And we don't do that super well. And it's just good to hear that we're looking at how we can do that better.
Yeah, I can get with that. All right, Josh, how about you?
Well, Dan and Paula Burns have already told me what my one good thing is because I went to Mexico.
And we appreciate you listening, Dan and Paula. Go on.
Absolutely. But I went to Mexico and with the family, and I've paid zero attention to all news while gone.
God bless you.
But what's actually been really—
in Mexico, too, right now.
Sure.
Because the Gulf of what? Oh.
No idea. ignorance is bliss.
It is.
What actually is the good thing is coming back and seeing and having conversations with people who were genuinely interested and wanting to know how our trip was and how the family did. It wasn't just like small talk and, you know, I'm asking out of obligation. It's
sure.
Like, genuine relational conversations with folks. And that was actually really sweet and encouraging coming back and having people actually want to engage. To yeah, it
nice.
Was great.
And that is what Paula told you your best thing would be?
Yes.
Well, there you go. All right. I mean, she's not wrong. All right. Mine is silly and shallow, but this Sunday, a few days from today, a gentleman by the name of Hubie Brown is ending his career as an NBA broadcaster. Before that, he was a coach. Hubie Brown was not a young man when I was a kid. Homeboy is 91.
Come on.
And has been broadcasting and like, at a high level. He works, I'm blanking on it now, what network he's with now, but like ABC, like really high level. And man, I have no desire to work until I'm 91.
Sure.
I don't know, maybe if my job was broadcasting NBA games, I would. But I just think, man, that level of longevity, that level of being somebody who's beloved within the profession and just doing what you love for that long,
Man, I am inspired by it. And I think the game is like during church on Sunday, so I will not be watching. But I may have to try to see if I can catch a little bit of it just to celebrate the great Hubie Brown. And that kind of longevity is pretty, pretty amazing stuff.
Such an interesting name, Hubie. Hubie. I mean,
you know, he's 91.
I don't know. Give me a
Hubert word. Herbert. I don't know.
Hubie.
It's different era, different era, my man. All right, we'll be right back. So, gentlemen, I was driving the other day, and I turned on a podcast, the Sunday version of New York Times The Daily, where they tend to do a longer form read of a longer news story, and the story was about Ozempic, and it was talking about the myriad benefits of the medication that are continuing to be discovered. And obviously, it's known as a weight loss drug, and it's had some phenomenal results in terms of folks being able to drop body weight and get kind of healthier in that area. But it is doing so much more in terms of lowering blood pressure. It's having potential fertility benefits. It's decreasing the risk of kidney failure. It's decreasing the risk of heart disease. And what was most remarkable to me is how it is legitimately changing people's preferences for food, whereas processed food, which we've all been kind of, you know, programmed to be addicted to highly processed food, that is actually losing its appeal for folks who are taking Ozempic, and they're craving things like raspberries and vegetables and things
Listen,
of that.
The McDonald's lobbyists are quaking in their boots.
Well, and that was, so a side note of that article was the idea of how is like processed food trying to like deal with the fact that people don't want processed food anymore. But Pastor Judah, what is your reaction to hearing all of these potential benefits that we're seeing from these types of medications?
Listen, according to Helen Thompson, who writes for New Scientist, Ozempic can solve all the problems. It can fix everything. Are you sad? Take some Ozempic. Your wife cheating on you? Get you some Ozempic. Your children getting suspended? Ozempic. I'm telling you right now, it sounds like a blessing. Listen, I'm always a little bit wary of anything that feels like a catch-all. You know, when they say, like, it can do all these, I'm always a little bit nervous, and I'm always a little bit nervous about new stuff. But listen, the idea that everything from fertility to appetite, that it can be helpful with that, I'm like, listen, cook me up 27 of them and keep that kitchen hot. Because I, listen, especially with weight loss, right, that's a really hard thing to navigate. Mm-hmm. It's a really hard thing to figure out. And so all of the tools that, you know, are at our disposal, I don't know, it's just a reminder that it's a hard time to be alive in the world, but also in some ways, it's a really wonderful way to be alive. Now, what I need is for Ozempic to make it in like a shot form or like something not with a needle. Like, can we get a little powder that we just throw in our morning coffee? Because I'm not here for the needles.
Are we not a needle? Not
Listen,
a needle
I'm
person?
Not a fan. I'm not a fan. I have to give up a little pep talk even when I'm getting blood drawn. I tell the little person, I say, listen, you have one shot. If you miss this vein, I promise you the day is over.
Hey, I'll tell you, same. I still look away when they have to like
100%.
Poke me.
Oh my gosh.
Took my son in for a blood draw the other day, looked right at it. I'm like, what?
I watch it go in, and then I'm trying to race the people around me. I'm like, I can get more blood out of me.
Not I.
Now that we've made all of the
I don't want the intern. I don't want
out.
The newest graduate. Give me the senior citizen.
Josh.
With a shaky hand?
Well,
no.
Well.
A medication like this obviously has incredible promise. And as with any medication, more research is being done to figure out long-term effects and things like that. What cautions do we need to take? Like, leaving aside, let's just say we know for a fact that there aren't any major health implications down the road, just for the sake of argument.
Yeah.
Leaving aside that, what cautions do we need to bring to the way that we think about these types of therapeutic interventions that really do have the power to make a real difference in people's lives?
Yeah, I think it's always something that we have to be really cautious of saying that things that don't require discipline in order to get results may not be very long-lasting. And so, like, we just watched Jurassic Park with our kids. I know. Good parenting.
Parenting book forthcoming.
Yes.
Go on.
But there's a line that Jeff Goldblum's character, Ian Malcolm, has that's like, you stood on the shoulders of somebody else, but you did, none of this science required any discipline. Hmm. And I also think about that in the spiritual formation side for us, that anything that does not require discipline is probably not long lasting, and we probably don't really understand the ramifications of it. You know, right now we're seeing all these benefits, but 10 years from now we might see a whole lot of other things come up. It's like, oh, maybe that wasn't so great. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's because it didn't require discipline for a lot of folks. So I think right now the latest stat was like 40% of people who come off the drug regain all of their weight. Yeah. You know, and that's a pretty high percentage. And so it's like, does that mean you're going to be taking this forever?
Yeah.
Are you changing all of your habits? So if it doesn't require discipline, and it's just a quick and easy answer, it's probably not going to last the way that you think it is. And it's not going to make that long-term change.
Yeah. It was interesting. A gentleman in our congregation who's a friend of mine asked me to watch this video on YouTube that was critiquing some kind of more charismatic expressions of faith. And the critique in the video I thought was interesting, as these folks were talking about kind of expressions of Christianity where it is so so slanted to the realm of like, come on in and get the demons cast out of you.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the catch-all for everything. Mm. And certainly demonic stuff is real, and certainly we believe in telling demons to get out, right? But
also take your person.
But the point that these folks were making, and I was not familiar with them prior to seeing this video, was that it was kind of placing all of your eggs in the basket of, well, come on in and get that demon cast out of you.
Right.
And there was no attention given to the slow and careful work of spiritual formation. Mm, yeah. And I use the expression, like, it's not an oil change, you know?
Right.
Oh, all right, demons have sort of built up. I need to go just get them cast out. And his point was to go not to say that there's no place for that, but to go, on some level, if we're looking for something to replace the steady, slow discipline with God's help of personal holiness, of growing in our faith, that, like, that's not going to work. And I think there's, you know, it's not difficult to see the corollary here, to go, this can help a lot. Like, anyone who's ever tried to lose weight, like, I remember the last time I tried to, it's terrible. Like, anybody who tells you it's not terrible is lying to you, right?
Yeah.
If it was easy, none of us would ever have to do it, because it would be, so it's, and we look at this as a shortcut, and I'm all for the potential benefit, but we have to approach it with the realm of going, it's okay, yes, this will help, but it's not going to do all of the work for me.
Yeah, it's that concept of wraparound support. It's that real concept of, and I think that this applies to like every area of our life. Like, if you're having issues in your marriage, right, for sure, come see a marriage family therapist. But also, like, what else needs to happen, right? You need to, we got to approach all of our problems, understanding that, like, most of them need a multi-level, multi-approach solution.
Yes. Yeah, and I think there's a role of medical intervention within both mental health as well as physical health and spiritual health to some degree. While we wouldn't call it medical, we wouldn't use drugs for that necessarily, but, like, Stephen ministers and chaplain care type of things. So those those are great, like, hey, we need help right now type of things. And there's a role for that. But at the same time, if we're not trying to take on the disciplines to grow in our spirituality, to grow in our relationships with the Lord, we're not going to see that lasting change. Our small group, just started Deeply Formed Life, which we did with, encouraged by Rich Velotis, and it's so interesting to, it begins with slow down. And weight loss drugs are all about how fast you can get to your finish line. Mm-hmm. You know, and as somebody who is very overweight, I don't know if you noticed, but I
feel like you were setting us up to make a joke there, but any joke would just seem mean.
It
so
would be
I'm
mean.
Not going to.
Oh, and that's exactly what I was trying to rope you into. I will get you next
not
time,
taking
Gadget.
Not the bait this time. All right, yeah, go so, on.
But slowing down And the idea that in order for us to grow in our relationship with the Lord, we need to develop a slow pace.
Yeah.
And the same thing with even weight loss is that the people who lose weight over time tend to keep up that weight loss versus the people who have a crash diet and like, oh, I got all the way down and now it's all back on because we didn't deal with the underlying issues.
100%.
Food is, and your relationship with food is a reaction to underlying conditions.
100%.
The same thing with your spiritual walk is your relationship with God is evidence of something else. Mm-hmm. And so to try to sprint towards a finish line with that, you're actually going to miss a lot of the long lasting and reparative and healing work that needs to be taking
place.
That's
really important.
Okay, so I agree with all of that. So I guess my question to challenge that a little bit, and it's tricky because there's not like an Ozempic for your spiritual life. Like, here's a pill you can take that'll make you not want to watch Netflix,
that's what
but
people
want
think,
to pray.
Though. Think about when people like church hop a lot, right? Like it's like if I just come and hear this teacher and just come to this house, all my spiritual issues
and podcast.
100%.
Ignore the fact that this is a podcast, but like, but people are like, well, I listen to this podcast religiously, so now my spiritual walk is done. And so I love the Bema podcast. It's walking through scripture. I love it. But it does not replace my spiritual walk with the Lord outside of that thing.
Yeah.
Sure.
So that's like the Ozempic for my spiritual walk if I allowed it to be.
Okay. Yeah. All right. That's fair. I suppose that works. So my question for you then is we're talking about the problem of kind of looking for the quick fix, of looking for the solution. Does that mean there's a problem with even looking at medications like Ozempic and trying to utilize them or not? And I guess I would pose that to either of you.
No, I mean, I think, as Josh said, that medical intervention has its place, right? Mm-hmm. And if there are tools available that you feel like are helpful, then use them. But also just understand that is one piece of a larger solution.
Yeah.
And you need to be thinking about the larger solution and not just asking for an Ozempic martini on the rocks.
Can I get an Ozempic latte? That sounds
Ozempic.
Awful. Okay. All right.
Ozempic macchiato.
Dirty with an extra olive. Got it. For me, I think there is a role within that. We have a society that is so overweight, mm-hmm. for example. Let's just take the weight side of this. That we have a higher obesity in children than we've ever seen. We have a higher obesity rate. And it's not just like a BMI. Well, we changed our definitions of what that is. Like, no, we're noticeable.
It's legit.
Like, when I was a kid, when you saw somebody in the 300-pound, like, it was abnormal. Now it's pretty common.
Yeah.
And so I think when we have a societal thing like that, a little medical help to get us going and to reset our bodies properly, since we don't really know why we have such a big thing. I think that's...
Yes, we do. The McDonald's lobbyists,
yes. That's a portion of it.
Sure.
But if you stop there,
It's not going to do all the work.
It's not
going to
do all the work for us.
Is that fair? No, and I agree with that. And I'm very pro Ozempic and these types of medications. And I think if we can do more to make them more readily available for people, it's obviously very expensive. That would be beneficial.
Yeah, $2,000 a month.
Yeah, that's a little pricey.
I need
the caution that I would put. This gets back to kind of a spiritual health question, is we have to ask the question, what are we asking this thing to do for us?
Right.
And we have to ask that about anything. What am I asking my job to do for me? I mean, I think about this with fitness stuff all the time. Like, I love fitness, I love exercise, I love the things that I do, but I'm always having to check in with myself. Like, to what extent am I compensating for the fact that I was a weak and scrawny kid and I'm trying to sort of like tell that kid he's okay, if I'm being really honest?
Wow.
To what extent am I asking physical performance in a certain way to be an identity marker for me? And I have to remind myself all the time, I can hit every, like, I think it's great to have goals. I have big goals this year for things I want to accomplish in kind of the endurance racing element of my life. And like, I think it's great to do that. And I make no apologies for it, but I have to be able to recognize, like, the moment you cross the finish line, you start thinking about the next goal. Mm. That it's not going like, if I'm asking that to be my identity, it's not going to work. So I have to keep it in its right place.
Yeah.
If I'm pursuing weight loss to go, well, that's just going to be the be-all and end-all. Like, now we've made it an idol,
yeah,
and it's not going to do that. That we have, like, we're still the same person, and we're still invited to find our identity in Christ, whether we weigh 150, 300, or 450. Mm-hmm. And I think to think that any sort of outside intervention is going to help with that, like, we just have to recognize it can draw our attention in our kind of what we're looking for to kind of save us,
yeah,
in the wrong direction.
That's good.
All right, we'll be right back.
Welcome back. We are going to have a discussion now about DEI.
Oh, fun.
This is fun.
This isn't controversial, is it?
No, not at all. But what we're going to do our best to do is not to talk about the political side of this. We just want to get back into what is DEI,
yeah, that's right,
because right now it feels like it's being blamed for a lot of things, and that's not helpful. We just want to take a moment and get back down to the foundations of it. What is DEI? What is not DEI? Can we be sober-minded about how we think about this, how we engage in it? Agreeing or not agreeing is not really the focus today, but just what is it? What are we talking about? So, Pastor Judah, you have the most experience in being a trainer in this area. So what are the basic foundations of DEI?
Yeah. So I think a couple things. One, I think that DEI has become popular right now because we have language for it. Mm-hmm. But the basic principles of it have existed in this country for actually a really, really long time, right? So DEI is an acronym that stands for diversity, which means multiple voices, mm-hmm, at the table. The opposite of which is homogeny, which would say everybody at the table should be the exact same. And more than just ethnicity, right? There can be diversity of thought, diversity of lived experience, diversity of economics.
Yeah.
The E stands for equity, and equity just says we should take a look at people as whole people when we're considering what do they need in order to have the same opportunities that we do. So, for example, if we say, hey, we all need to pick apples from this tree, and I'm 6'2 and you're 5'9, right? Equity says, okay, what would be equitable is if we get the 5'9 guy a stool to stand on so that he can have the same reach to the apples that the 6'2 guy does, right?
Equality of opportunity, not necessarily equality of outcome. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Balance of opportunity.
Yeah.
And then the I stands for inclusion, which just says that all the voices are not just at the table, but they have power at that table. They can kind of contribute in equitable ways at the table.
And so how do you define power at the table when you say that phrase? What does that mean?
Yeah. And so this is where it becomes a lot to process, because that depends on who we're talking about and where we're talking about, right? For example, a part of it may be people don't realize that, like, wheelchair ramps, that is a DEI initiative, right? Because it says, well, we want to make sure that whatever this building is, this post office that we all have to mail our stuff at, this bank that we all have to put our money in, this grocery store that we have to buy our food at, that we want to make sure that everybody has the same access and can contribute to that space. And so one of the things that is really wonderful about DEI is that it gives us an opportunity to benefit everybody, to bless everybody, to say, okay, are you in a wheelchair? Do you have a disability? Or are you somebody whose brain works a little bit differently? Maybe you're on the spectrum. And it allows us to say, how can we make sure, one, that you are at the table contributing? Because whatever our product is, just from a business standpoint, right, we want to sell a lot of it. We want to sell the most amount of it.
Right.
So how can we make sure that your demographic, your population, your people have access to the products? It's just good business practice.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Obviously, right now, there's a ton of attention on DEI in terms of ethnicity and all of that. But what people groups have actually benefited from DEI practices the most?
Yeah. So a lot. Forbes put out an article where they cited a McKinley study. McKinley is a firm, basically an equity firm that kind of helps organizations figure out how to maximize their hiring practices in a way that allows them to make better business decisions and make more money. And they were saying that the number one benefactor of DEI programs in terms of the hiring programs has been white women. Right? Because we forget that, like, women haven't been allowed to be in the workforce for that long, and women have experienced a whole lot of, lack of opportunity, lack of resources. But, like, I have a little list here of some things that are DEI initiatives. So we talked about ramps and sidewalk curbs, but subtitles and captions on TV, that's DEI. Family restrooms, including mother's rooms, breastfeeding rooms. Mm-hmm. That's a DEI initiative. Changing tables in men's restrooms. Mm-hmm. Floating paid holidays, pay equity and pay transparency, parental leave, right? We haven't always had mama and daddy could be at
right.
home
yeah,
for sure. the birth of little Josh Oop.
We call him Declan, but that's fine.
No. Declan is Declan. That's so funny.
Yeah.
Belt extenders on planes, gluten-free options at restaurants, smoking and non-smoking areas at businesses, wellness programs, relaxed dress codes, employee recognition programs, large print materials. When you go to a place and they have printed out the stuff in really big letters so that you can see, regardless of where you're the health of your eyes. So these are all things that DEI programs, because they say, hey, what do we need to do to make sure that everybody can have a seat at the table and have equal access to opportunity at the table?
Yeah.
What I want to say this, what DEI is not is hiring underqualified people, right? Like that's actually not a part of the equation. DEI says, hey, I want to have access to all of the best candidates for this particular position.
Right.
And in a lot of ways, outside of the kind of politicization of this topic, it's just good business practice. Mm-hmm. It just actually makes a lot of sense that if I'm going to hire somebody, I want to see who's the best of the best from every kind of corner so that I'm actually picking the best person for my job.
Now, obviously, a lot of the controversy around DEI is politically motivated in one way or another.
Sure.
But there's obviously been a lot of critiques. In your mind, in what ways has corporate America or specific corporations or even the government or just kind of anybody, like, where is kind of, I don't know, DEI been not helpful or not implemented in ways that actually fulfill kind of the positive vision that you just shared?
Yeah. One of the challenges in the DEI space right now is that it's just not regulated, so that there's not one kind of standard for what those trainings look like or what those consultants bring into the space. And so your experience, you can have a wide-ranging experience with those kinds of programs and with the folks who are implementing those programs. There's also this way that it can be kind of performative. And so that's where we're just kind of saying the things because it's the nice thing to say and kind of the popular thing to say. And really, that's not actually helpful. What we actually need is for just us to realize that, again, this is hugely beneficial in both directions, that the more we give people access to our product, to our boardrooms, you know, we all know that if we sit around and brainstorm an idea, that the more diverse the people are around that table, the better the idea tends to be.
Right.
And I think that we also, I think one of the things is that there has not been a lot of very loud voices that are explaining what DEI actually is. And so, unfortunately, DEI sometimes is characterized as kind of just handouts to Black people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something, I think, to be processed about, like, why we would have a hard time with a program that does benefit Black people. But the reality is that it benefits more than just Black people. And in so many different areas. And so if you have a kid who has autism, DEI is something that you want to be paying attention to because you want your kid to be able to get a job and have access to school, yeah. right? IEPs, yeah. that's a DEI initiative, right? Yeah. If you have any sort of physical disability, if you are poor, right? There, so much of DEI efforts are really about recruitment. Right, are about saying, hey, at some point, the people that we have right now who are experts and doing excellent at the job, at some point, they're going to retire. And in this country where we'd like to retire younger rather than older, yeah. right, DEI says, okay, so you need to be recruiting and training the next generation in whatever the industry is. And maybe you ought to consider investing some of that recruitment and training in places where it doesn't happen. So, for example, there is not a lot of tech recruiting that happens in rural communities, right? Now, rural communities are often largely white, but those kids, the assumption that we make about those kids is like, oh, daddy was a tractor driver, so you're going to be a tractor driver, and that's just it, as opposed to saying, no, 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 some of that STEM money that went to districts like the one we live in right now, maybe some of that money should also go to the kids in rural Marin County who do live on farms or in, you know, these rural communities, but to say, hey, this is an option for you, this STEM, this tech, this is an option for you, and here are some resources for you to get involved in. And so, yeah, that I think it's imperfect, and there's always work to be done in it. But ultimately, DEI is about this concept of bringing folks to the table so that the product is the best and the community is the best and the company represents its clientele.
Yeah. One of the things that I struggle with in some of the implementation with DEI things is when it gets into the motivations and intentions of other races. So you hear this, it's probably a small amount that it's actually happening, but it gets the most play on radio and stuff like that of like companies saying that all white people are bad and evil and blah, blah. It's like, okay, maybe somebody's saying that. But when,
who?
It's like, yeah, give me a name. Say yeah. their names. Yeah.
Who said this? Yeah. Maybe somebody, like, I don't know.
Send me a link. You
exactly.
know, like, it doesn't exist.
But even if that were the case, like, it's recognizing that every political movement, every church movement has somebody who can shift this for financial gain for themselves.
Sure.
And so we've got people in the Christian faith that have done that. Time and time again, that they have manipulated a church system or a process
itself.
Or scripture, whatever, in order to be financially beneficial to themselves. And I think the reason why I set this up with the phrase sober-minded is that we should not be super reactionary because that's how we get fooled into different things.
Yeah.
I honestly believe that if we took Matthew 6, Sermon on the Mount stuff, and we really walked through that one by one, more people would understand social justice and why that was a focus for Jesus.
Yeah.
It's full there. Like,
right.
like
yeah.
it's just, it, that that is there. Now, what people have a problem with, from my estimation, is this fear of it.
Yeah.
And this fear, and it's not just power loss, even though that is a portion of it. Anytime that you're like, oh, I'm starting to lose my advantage, that mm-hmm. feels, even if you can't voice it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There is something about misunderstanding the goal of Christianity, that mm-hmm. the goal of Christianity is not for the betterment of me. The goal of Christianity is to love God and love people. And to love God well leads us to loving people well. And when we love people well, we care about things like equity.
Yeah.
Now, we might completely disagree with how we implement those.
Sure.
Right.
And that's a different conversation.
Sure.
But to throw out this idea that we don't care about equity or inclusion or diversity because that's not what the Bible teaches, it's like, that's wrong.
Yeah.
The right. Bible does teach this.
Right.
And I do have a personal, ugh, anytime somebody says that diversity is our greatest strength, it's like, no, unity with inner diversity is our greatest strength. Mm. Figuring out how to be for one another and being diverse.
Yeah, that's right.
Diversity for the sake of diversity is more chaos than help. And I think that's probably where some of the implementation might have gone awry for some sectors. Sorry. When we don't have unity in what we're doing, you're always going to have dysfunction.
Yeah, I'll tell you this. In BYA, in our ministry, I have a leadership team. And we had, for a long time, these folks who would come to BYA and they would just sit in the back. They would, like, as far away from the stage as possible on these couches we have in the back room. And it would look like they weren't paying attention and they didn't, you know, and that they weren't engaged. And it kind of looked rude. And fortunately, I had somebody on my team who was on the spectrum who helped me to understand that those were people who were experiencing overstimulation and that they were very overwhelmed. And so they wanted to be at church, but they were trying to be as far away from the strobe lights and the very loud music and all of these things. And because that person was on my team, they were able to help me understand that so that we were able to invest in sensory kits, right?
That's cool.
And these kits that these people can have, and they have headphones and different things in them that can help them to regulate so that they can be in church and not have a terrible experience. And the only reason that I got any clarity about that was because I have a team that has some diversity on it, because I have a team with somebody who's lived experience, right? And so I think that the fear comes from a couple of things. One, it comes from change, right? People are nervous about change, and also people feeling like they're going to lose opportunities. But this was the same fear that people had when they were talking about the Emancipation Proclamation, right? When we were talking as a country about, hey, let's end slavery, the fear was, well, all of these people, they're going to take our jobs, and they're going to take our homes, and they're going to take, and they're going to take, and we're not going to have anything. Yeah. And what history shows us is, like, that's actually not what happened. Yeah. That actually everybody was all right, and you kept your house and you kept your job. And so what we have seen just from history is that these kind of efforts make for a better, more functional, more wealthy society. Hmm. There are a lot of reasons why the United States is the wealthiest country in the world. One of them is that we have so many different people contributing to every industry, right? To every marketplace. And so I think the important thing is, one, even if we're struggling with the implementation of it, one, to just know what it is, right? To be, because there's this willful ignorance that we can kind of lean into where these words become catch-alls for sentiments, right? And so DEI has become kind of the language that we use for anything that pisses us off, right? For anything that frustrates us or that feels different. And it's the same thing that we did with woke. It's the same thing we did with critical race theory. It's the same thing we did with politically correct. Yeah. And words have meanings. We should know what they mean.
And it's important for us to recognize, and I'm glad you brought that up, that there are incentives to get us hysterical and fearful. So, you said, Pastor Judah, that there aren't loud voices talking about DEI. And I understand what you meant there. But I would push back, and I think you'd agree with this, that there actually are very loud voices talking about DEI. Mm-hmm. They're just using it in the way that we used critical race theory 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say, like, I still don't have an opinion on critical race theory because it is a complex academic theory. I have not read, like, a book
graduate level theory.
Yeah, graduate level. I have not read a book length treatment on it from a critical race theory scholar. And I'm just not going to be somebody who has somebody who goes on TV and shouts partisan talking points explain things to me. Like, I'm just not that to me. I'm like, I'm not that naive to believe that that person is telling me the truth. So I think we have to recognize that these words truly are weaponized to make us hysterical. That is the point. That the people who are loud, and I have no opinion about critical race theory. The people that were loudest about criticizing it did not understand it. They were using it to scare people, to increase division, and increase sort of support for their side. That is exactly what is happening with DEI right now. And Josh, you made the point earlier that we need to be able to be sober-minded. Understand, the partisan political world does not encourage sober-mindedness. It encourages fear. It encourages hysterics. It encourages demonization. So we can't let those voices be the voices that are helping us understand what this concept is. If we are going to critically analyze it from a standpoint of like, I want to actually understand it, we have to be able to do the work and not let highly partisan voices in the media elsewhere tell us what these
especially
things are.
Especially because we do so to our own detriment, right?
Oh,
so you may be a, you know, straight cisgender white male, right? And feel like this DEI stuff has nothing to do with you. But the amount of DEI initiatives that have benefited veterans, right? Mm-hmm. That are making sure that veterans have what they need, that they are being considered for jobs post-military. Veterans sometimes have a really hard time getting work once they are no longer in the military, right? And so we all know somebody who served in the military. And don't we want to live in a country where, hey, after you put your life on the line for this country, we're going to make sure that you have a job and that you have income and that you have access, right? And so remembering that diversity and inclusion mean a lot of things for a lot of people.
Yeah,
absolutely. We will be right back.
So all three of us at this table, and I'm sure a great many of our listeners, are travelers. We love to go to a place. And a lot of places, you got to get on an airplane. And, you know, either in real life or on social media, we have all seen those videos or heard stories of the crazy passengers who are flipping out and cussing everybody out and being dramatic and all the things. But apparently, like, that's not just stuff that goes viral on social media. Like, it's a real thing. And one of the things that airline passengers or airline stewardesses and stewards talk about is who are the worst types of passengers. And to my surprise, and maybe you guys as well, it was not the first class people. It was not the business class people. Nor was it the economy people. It was none other than the economy plus people. Now, if you don't know what Economy Plus is, that just means you paid a little bit of extra. You're still in the economy section, but you can bring in two carry-ons. You have a couple of extra added perks and benefits. What I want to know from you gentlemen is, first of all, do you have a crazy passenger on a plane story that you've experienced? Have you ever seen something or someone behave in a way that you were like, yikes, even if it's not as dramatic as the people who are like jumping over tables and
I've seen people be just kind of annoying or maybe have a little too much to drink or maybe they're a little bit loud. Certainly I've never seen anything like huge, like, oh my gosh, you know, something that's going to show up on the internet later. I don't know. Josh, have you?
So we took a flight.
That was not you. Sorry. Yeah. I just needed
to. No. I fight on planes for fun. That's the only reason I get on Southwest is for the brawl.
And it would be on Southwest if it would be a brawl.
So taking a flight, this is, probably 12, 13 years ago. And it was a short flight. It was like from Vegas to LA type of a thing, like on a, just a short leg of something. And on Southwest, and a guy had his A boarding. So he's in his early boarding, gets on the flight, picks his seat, and then is mad that anybody sat next to him and starts saying, I paid extra for this upgrade so that I can be in here, and then now you're saying that this person gets sitting there. And it just starts getting louder and louder and louder, and I'm just sitting two rows back, and I'm thinking, bro, you are on Southwest.
You made your choice.
There's no class on Southwest. It's just
equitable.
It's just
diversity,
there.
Equity, and inclusion.
Like, you show up and get on the plane. That is the end of the conversation. 100%. And but because he paid for that, you know, that A1 through 15, he was so mad that anybody had the audacity
the
to sit
and the
next
gumption.
Him. Yeah. I was like, okay, bud.
I was on a recent trip, I was flying back from like LA. It was a short thing too. I think it was LA to Sacramento or Vegas to Sacramento. And I was on Spirit. Now, I try really hard not to make that decision a lot, but sometimes you have to do it.
I've heard that's a little rough.
Listen, it's not the Holy Spirit. I'm going to tell you that. listen, all you need to fly Spirit is a driver's license, and they'll let you drive the plane yourself. But I was on there, and it was this. It was so awkward because there was this dude, and the middle seat was empty, but he was on the aisle. I was on the window. And I guess he was, like, unfamiliar with Spirit. And if you've never flown Spirit, like, it's a budget airline, which means that they take a bunch of shortcuts so that they don't have to charge you as much. So you get charged for bringing on, like, even, like, your personal item. And you can get charged if you don't print out your own ticket or have it on your phone, if you make them do it at the desk. You get charged for everything. No, they don't give you no free pretzels and water. Like, everything's... And I guess he didn't know. And so he was fussing about this very loudly, but he was doing it in, like, the passive-aggressive... Like, Brian, you're sitting right across from me. If you're the steward and Josh and I, who are sitting across from you, are the passengers, he's like... Josh, I hate this airline. The fact that they charge for everything.
Oh, boy.
Well, it was just so awkward because he's talking to me and I'm like, sir, I don't know you and I don't want to talk about this. And the steward is like irritated with you and I don't want him to think that we're like together, like we know each other or anything. It was terrible.
That's funny.
Here's what I want to know. What do you think the reason is for specifically Economy Plus passengers being more poorly behaved or more likely to be poorly behaved?
Well, I think about it the same way that I reflect on my 20s. And with shame, by the way.
intense
shame. But I reflect back to when I started to make, like, a living. And looking back, it's like I was barely making anything. Mm-hmm. But this kind of I deserve mentality starts creeping up. Mm. That actually probably stemmed way more from my insecurity. Mm. It wasn't because I was making real money. I was working at a church for, I think, $1,200 a month. It wasn't exactly, earth shattering, but it was just this, like, now my opinions matter because I'm on this staff and I can do this and everybody should know my opinion. That I think had way more to do with my insecurities than it actually had to do with station of life. Yeah. And I think about that in that premium economy, Economy Plus, where you've paid a little bit extra because you feel like I deserve a little bit more. I want a little bit better for myself and I'm willing to spend the extra $30 or whatever it is mm-hmm. per ticket. Mm-hmm. And that entitles me to something else. And I think it's that mentality of entitlement of I've spent a little bit more. I should be getting a lot for that investment back.
Well, and I think you have the challenge of, I think, in some cases, this is just my theory, that if, okay, I'm paying for Economy Plus, that means I am conscious of the fact that there are different layers here, right? That there's Economy, Economy Plus, Business Class, First Class. Mm. I want to play the game to get the premium experience, but I either can't afford, that's usually the case, or I'm, for whatever other reason, unwilling to really pay for what's going to be like super
thing.
Premium.
Yeah.
So I have this insecurity that comes from wanting to play I want to get into the upper strata game, but I don't quite have the resources to get there. So I think to your point, Josh, there is this sense of going, well, I don't have this and I'm frustrated by it.
Yeah.
And an interesting study I read recently said that they looked at behavior on airplanes based on whether or not people in Economy or Economy Plus had to walk by first class or not when they boarded the plane. And continuously it showed our behavior was worse when we had to walk by first class. It's almost like that reminder of,
hello,
you know,
poor people.
This is where the real action is, mm-hmm. made us that much more insecure.
I think there's also the element of probably for folks when you're doing Economy Plus, that spending that extra $30 or $50 or whatever it is more weighty for you, for your pocketbook, right? Like if you're in business class or first class, you're not in it because it was a struggle to make it happen. Because if we're honest, most of us probably could afford a business class ticket. It just, we wouldn't have nothing left.
Right. Like staying in Motel 6 for a night in our destination and then we're flying home.
You understand. And so I think that there's something about when it feels more costly, right? When it feels like more of a sacrifice that makes you feel like, well, I better get my money's worth. I mean, I remember I was in London and I spent big money to get front row tickets to see Wicked, a particular version of Wicked. Yeah. And one of the reasons I wanted to see it is because the lead character was an actress that I really, really love and have followed for a long time. I really want to see her. And she was sick that night. And my attitude was so bad. I'm so embarrassed to say this. I literally was in that girl's inbox like, ma'am, I flew across the world to see this. And the next day, she posted on her Instagram, sorry, guys, I'm going to be there. I was sick. And so I went again. I bought tickets again to see it. And I met her at the stage door. And I was like, hey, I'm the guy who wrote you. And, like, the amount of, like, pullback that she had initially. But it was because it had cost me significantly. Like, whereas somebody else, maybe it wasn't as big of a sacrifice for them. For me,
yeah,
it was a big amount of money. And so I had some entitlement. I felt like I was entitled to that particular performance, even though the performance I saw initially was fantastic. It was fine.
Right.
So I think that there's that at play.
So to parlay this back into like spiritual life, like where do you see this kind of thing popping up within Christians, within our own communities?
I mean, I think that we are so heavily discipled into consumerism, every single one of us, including the three of us.
Oh yeah.
That it is an act of incredible resistance to live our lives in a way where we are not thinking about what we are entitled to all the time, because it is simply the air we breathe. And I'm not, and even I have some compassion, I think, for, because all of us feel entitled to a certain degree. I have some compassion for those of us who are in that space, because it is everywhere.
Right.
We are constantly told that kind of, you know, it's all about us. We are constantly exposed to, sort of like in the flight example, to other people that have it, quote unquote, right, better than us. Social media leads to endless comparison.
Yeah.
And when we get stuck in this insecure, sort of entitled, I wish I had what they had mentality, I just don't think we're built to be able to tolerate that very well. So I think about the words of scripture in 1 Timothy where Paul is instructing Timothy, with godliness with contentment, there is great gain.
Right.
Like, that is a radically countercultural idea. And I think that when we go back to, you know, the words of Jesus, Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve.
Yeah.
All of our culture is telling us all the time, you are to be served.
Yeah.
And we see this in Christian spaces, right? And it's not to say that we as a church don't have responsibility to make sure we're helping people out and you know, doing all the things that we're meant to
100%.
Do. But, I mean, you know this, Josh, the disproportionate amount of complaints we get about, oh, the church isn't meeting my needs, come from folks who really aren't that invested.
Correct.
Yeah.
In general. Now, there are some sects where...
Sometimes we screw up and people care.
I take, like, our singles ministry, for example. We've had to take a really long pause on it, and because we need to get some leadership stuff and some strategy, some vision for it locked in and all that. And that was a need that people are like, hey, we need... And that's...
Sure.
And that's completely understandable. So I'm not talking about that.
So now
person.
We're rolling out fishersofmen.com.
That's an interesting title.
That's a name.
Yeah, I'm not into that one. But
it's Bible.
But the folks who complain the loudest are usually the minority of voices, and are the least invested.
Yeah.
And we saw this a lot in COVID too. The people that hated the way that we handled COVID, for good and bad reasons, whatever, that left, the majority of which were not actually participating in the ministries of the church. And so one objective example that you can look at for that is giving. Like, we had a 25% drop in attendance. We had like a 6% drop in giving. Is that about right?
It was very minimal.
And so the percentages didn't match each other.
And that's during COVID.
And so that's one of those things that's like, okay, a lot of these voices, while loud, were not truly invested into the body.
And I think that's a good reminder for all of us to go, number one, where am I invested in terms of trying to help? I mean, Abraham Lincoln said, he who has no heart to help has no right to complain. I'm getting the words wrong, but that was the gist of it. To go, okay, if I'm going to be loud in a place, I want to be invested and I want to be constructive.
Right.
And I think too often it's easy to be loud on airplanes. It's mm-hmm. easy to be loud at the grocery store. It's easy to be loud where I can just complain.
Yeah.
And I feel this.
There's
this
also no enforcement, or you feel like there's not, right? Like when yeah. you get on a plane, you it's different than when you're in the airport and you see security every, you know, every 10 yeah. meters or whatever.
Yeah.
On the plane, I think that there's this assumption often steward people, airline stewards are women. Mm-hmm. They're always very polite. They're, you know, very well dressed. And so I think that there's this assumption that you can get away with behaving more poorly on a plane than I think that you would in some other spaces.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's recognizable in my email inbox, where people feel very free to be very direct with yeah. me via email, and then I meet with them face to face, and it's way
real
calmer.
Sweet. And it's like the same energy,
way yeah. more.
Well, your
way
thing
more
about
subtle.
The actress, the same thing,
yeah.
right?
Like, yeah. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, call me out, Pastor. I hear you.
but yeah. I mean, that's a whole other topic of like we can have all this keyboard animosity because we don't have to look someone in the eye. But anyway.
Yeah, don't have to look somebody in the eye. But I think I'm just thinking through it as a Christian walking through life. There are things that I expect the church to help me with. Mm-hmm. There are things that I expect my community to come around me for.
Yeah.
But then there's things that they should also expect from me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I'm trying to do a better job of recognizing is people don't need to know every opinion that I have.
That's good.
What?
Brian was just...
just saying he doesn't need my opinion? No.
Well, that too.
But... But like this idea that just because I'm frustrated or just because I didn't like something or just because I like doesn't mean I need to tell anybody. Like it doesn't
yeah,
like
gosh. It's and, oh god. Yeah.
You know, and there were
yeah, first world
thousands
problems.
Of years where you couldn't tell anybody.
Right.
And even if you did, people were like, bro,
so?
We are starving.
So?
Who cares? Yeah. Like, you don't, the trumpets are too loud. Got it.
Yeah, get over
like,
it.
You know, but like, and I think that's that tension is for us as believers, it's not that we shouldn't share our opinions or that we shouldn't voice concerns to our church.
Yeah.
It's the posture in which we do it.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you could apply that to so many different situations. As we begin to wrap up this segment, I want to, I've mentioned this book on the podcast before, but the book is called The Age of Grievance by a guy named Frank Bruni, who, and it was written recently, and it was kind of all about how, well, as the name would imply, sort of grievance is everywhere. And Bruni's not a Christian, and my recommendation of the book is to say nothing about his own worldview. I first heard about him because Russell Moore, the editor-in-chief yeah. of Christianity Today, had him on his podcast, and I'm going to link to that episode in the show notes because it was so interesting hearing him reflect on kind of this idea that we're a society of grievance. But here's one thing he pointed out in the book that I thought was pretty fascinating. He talked about a political philosopher from another country who came to America and studied Americans and noticed that Americans are, quote, forever brooding over advantages they do not possess.
Mm.
Want to take a shot at what year that was? I'll give you a hint. Not year, yesterday.
The year of our Lord.
That is
2010.
That is Alexis de Tocqueville, 1835.
What?
How he found that Americans, they are unusually attuned to their misfortunes. They may, and he says that, and that part of that is that in America, we have all of these big promises of kind of who we are. And with big promises come big disappointments. And that we have all of these kind of expectations that are not realistic. Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America, probably the favorite thing I read in college, by the way. But it is such a fascinating thing to go, even embedded in our American culture, which there is no place in the world I would rather live, is this sense of, I'm frustrated, I don't have more. And I think the message of the gospel in that is to go, actually, I have been given everything by a God who loves me.
Mm.
And to let that be, godliness with contentment is great gain. To allow that be what counteracts this, I gotta have more.
Yeah.
Which even in saying that, like, I feel, and I'm sure you guys do as well.
Yeah, I don't go to John Piper for a lot of things. our theological.
Josh. Yeah.
Nope.
A lot of good, tremendous of, good, but some different
but
different views
one,
on some stuff.
One of the good things that has always stuck with me is that God is most glorified when we are most satisfied
Ooh.
In Him.
In Him.
That's good.
Yep.
And that has always stuck with me, that yes, God, like when we are satisfied in God, when he is enough, we actually get to experience who he is. The Baymon podcast talks about that God was the God who knew when enough was enough. Hmm. He stopped creating after the sixth day. Like he knew when enough was enough, that he was satisfied in what he did. And we can be like God when we are satisfied and recognize when enough is enough.
Which I think means that we have to have like real gratitude practices, right? Like 100%. That's the way that we like protect ourselves from becoming economy plus people.
I wonder if the airplane freakouts are being done by folks who have gratitude practices. That's kind of my point.
I would be surprised. Right?
Thankful for something.
It's a good word for all of us. All right, we'll be right back. All right, we're going to close out the episode like we always do with a game. And, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So I think our two main games are a lot of fun. We are not doing Blessed or Stressed today. We are instead doing I Know You're Lying, which we invite you, dear listener, to play along at home and see how many items you can get correct in each of these categories. Very quick review. Each one of us is going to propose a topic to the other two, and the other two have to say how many items that kind of fit the parameters of that topic they can name, and then they will go back and forth saying, I can name two, I can name three, etc., until somebody either can't name anymore or believes the other person is lying, and that person will then have to put up or shut up. So my category for the two of you is United States capitals that start with the letters A through D. And you all can just make your faces. There are 18 of them. I thought about doing all state capitals, but had to limit it a little bit. There are 18 state capitals that start with the letters A through D. How many can you name, Josh?
One.
Right. Right.
Judah.
I can name two.
My wife is so ashamed of
this. This makes for a bad topic, but I'm secretly telling myself it's a great topic.
Johanna, my wife, would slay at this.
Would say 18 and just shut. What next?
Oh my gosh.
Just say
three.
All right. He can name three. All right, we got to move this along here, folks.
Okay. I know you're lying.
All right, give us three.
So Auburn, New York?
Auburn? No.
Nope. Dang it. Albany?
Albany. There it is. Okay. Albany, New York.
Thank you.
There you go.
Carson City, Nevada.
Think Georgia, think Alaska.
Not Alaska.
Anchorage, is it?
Nope. Not the state capital.
Never mind. But I couldn't even name three.
It's not, Juno.
Oh, man. I lied.
Liar.
Yeah. You got any?
False. No. Mine was, I had Anchorage, but apparently capital. Anchorage is wrong. Yep. And then Atlanta.
Atlanta.
I didn't think Atlanta was.
And
Concord, Augusta, Columbia, Bismarck, Boston. I mean, I was just looking
Boston.
At them.
Boston.
Cheyenne, Charleston, Columbia, Columbus.
I should have got Boston and Charleston.
All right. Well, that was kind of a lame category. Hopefully you guys have a better one. Josh, we'll go to you next.
The category I chose are World War II movies.
Oh, goodness.
Movies?
Okay, wait. All right. Okay.
With World War II. So World War II is one of the most prolific wars in movies, and there's a lot that connects. So as long as it's during that time period, it doesn't have to be an actual, like, shoot 'em ups.
All right. Like, about being on the front
lines. I can name two.
I can name three.
I can name four.
I can name five.
Oh, I don't know if I can do six. It is with that confidence that I will say I can do six.
All right.
I can do seven.
Thank you. Praise the Lord. I know you're lying.
Okay. Schindler's List.
Oh, good one.
Diary of Anne Frank. Boy in the Striped Pajamas. The now 6888.
Now he's just making up.
The Hiding Place. That's the Corey Ten Boom movie. Okay, we're so close. We're so close. Two more. You know what? Y'all are gonna give me a hard time for this, but stands. The first X-Men movie. Remember, it starts off with Magneto going into the concentration camp.
I will allow it.
I will take it.
But for all future names, it can't be like a scene. It's sex.
See, people want to move the goalposts when you start winning. You see how people do? Okay, I need one more. What's the rabbit movie with Scarlett Johansson?
The rabbit movie.
It came out like last year with Scarlett Johansson and her son. Is like hiding a boy.
You're missing a lot of easy ones here. So
what am I missing? Oh, help me.
Okay, Saving Private Ryan.
I've never seen that a day in my life.
Oh my gosh, Inglorious Bastards.
I've never
not
seen
for
that
children
a day in my life.
Patton, or adult.
Isn't Patton World War II?
I've never seen
Patton's
that.
World War II. Pearl Harbor.
Oh, Harbor. I have seen Pearl Harbor.
A League of Their Own qualifies. I feel like. All
listen,
of them off
the
fighting.
Point is that I got
the Gays Bridge at the River Kwai, the Pacific.
You had to get six. You got five.
No. I got seven.
Or no.
Boy Striped Pajamas, Schindler's List, Diary of Anne Frank, The Hiding Place.
A bunch of numbers.
Yeah, 6888.
Magneto.
X-Men. And the one with Scarlett Johansson. I'm forgetting the name.
Yeah, you didn't say the name.
But it's...
And
bro,
that's six.
It's like something rabbit. It's...
All right.
We're going to move on, but I'm going to find this. we're all clear.
I think we all agree... Judah did not win. All right, so I won that round. All right, Judah, what is your category?
Okay, I have two. You guys can choose which one you want to do.
Oh, great.
So the first one is Christian denominations, and the second one is Marvel superheroes.
Christian denominations, there are simply too many. We could be here all day, and I think we could come up with them. I know I am so Marvel ignorant, but I could probably come up with a handful of names. So I would say we do that one.
All right.
Up to you.
I can name four.
I can name 10.
I cannot name 11. So please, I know you are telling the truth. So hit us with
for
10.
The record, the movie is called Jojo Rabbit, and it came out what year?
Okay, I believe time's expired. 2019. Don't be a sore loser, Judah. All right,
10. All right, so Captain America.
This is easy.
There's Falcon. Then there's Hawkeye. Then there's Hulk. Then there's Spider-Man, obviously. You got Doctor Who.
I can't believe
Who.
You tapped out of 10. So
Doctor Who. You've got Scarlet Witch. You've got Captain Marvel. You've got... Did I say Hulk already? Yeah. I think you did. Gosh, there's just so many. You got Thor.
Mm-hmm. Hard to narrow it down. I know.
Now, diversity, equity, and inclusion us.
I got Falcon, Black Panther.
Fan
of. There you go.
I just want Black Panther. Yeah.
I can't believe you tapped out of 10.
I mean, I probably, like, I haven't heard of all of those.
You can just think about one Avengers movie. Right.
Iron Man.
Any X-Men.
Here's the thing. We all have areas of, like, collective pop culture knowledge where just the tank is empty.
That's fair.
Superheroes. Lord of the Rings.
I've never seen Inglourious Basterds.
Nothing. Neither have I, and never will.
Yeah.
But, you know.
I would not suggest it.
It's easy to have compassion for people that know nothing about stuff you know a lot about when you're forced to talk about things you know nothing about. So, I don't have a segue into our close, but we are done.
Thanks
for
listening.
Oh, thank God.
Like, comment, share, send this to somebody, rate, review, but only say nice things.